So you might replace that for the last one.
Okay.
Something like that.
Can I ask you what school or schools you're with?
I'm going to be a freshman at Tualatin High next year.
Are you? And Tyler?
Ryan.
Ryan, excuse me.
Tyler.
So Ryan, what school are you in?
I'm going to go to Hazelbrook.
Oh, yeah.
Is that your first year coming up there?
Yeah.
Ryan, so he's gone from elementary to all... Byram? Or?
Yeah, he was at Byram, and now he's going to go to Hazelbrook.
It's a big transition for you.
And Laura was at Hazelbrook last year.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. And Tyler, where are you in school?
Well, I just graduated from 12th and 9th this year.
Did you? Did you know my niece, grandniece, I guess, Kate Lasky. You know her?
The name sounds familiar.
Oh, okay. I think she graduated last year, as a matter of fact.
That's a huge school. You wouldn't believe how big it is.
And I understand, the grounds and everything is the largest in the state for a high school. I'd heard that.
But it is a very good school. I was really lucky to go there.
Yeah, right. Does it have a swimming pool?
Mm-hmm.
It does. Okay.
Mm-hmm. It has a swimming pool and a huge theater.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
We do a lot of theater productions. So.
Do you?
Are we ready?
I think we are.
Okay.
Let me just get things going here.
And your questions will be picked up on everything, too. So, and okay. Later on, we'll take a picture of the three of you with a still camera.
Oh.
Okay.
I'll take these off since, go ahead.
Should we start by asking her name? Or?
Yeah.
Okay, so what's your full name?
Yeah, Karen Lafke Nygaard.
Okay.
Lafke is my maiden name.
What's today's date?
Today's date is August 22nd, 2006.
Okay. So, were you born in a hospital, or did the doctor come to your house?
I was born in a hospital in Eugene. And I have a nice little story to tell there, if I may. It was 1925, and we were living on a farm in an old town called Meadowview. It wasn't a town, it was a little farming community, about 13 miles north of Eugene. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, so I'm told, I have an older brother who was 6, and took mother to the hospital, and I apparently... Dad took Mother into the hospital, and Herb stayed in the car, because he remembers telling me later, he remembered seeing a horse-drawn wagon delivering milk at that time. That's how far back that goes. But I was born in the hospital, to answer your question, yes.
What was happening in the news when you were born?
Well, right when I was born, I don't know, but a year and a half later, Lindbergh flew across the Atlantic Ocean, and that was the biggest news for that year and for decades to come, I think. But the very year I was born in December, so that was the end of the year. I can't think of anything, but the Lindbergh thing is the big thing that happened shortly after.
What did you do for fun as a child and a teen?
Well, I was lucky enough to live on a farm and have... bought big barns to play with in the days when hay was not baled but was just loosely put in the barn by a rather elaborate mechanism. So there's just loose hay that you could play in and jump down on from a higher platform. That was great fun. Outdoor fun was playing in the woods. We didn't have much of a woods on our property. It was all cleared farmed land, but there was a nice farm with big woods across the road. And they had, I think, 4 sons, played with them. And in the other direction was the Ibeck Woods. And I played there with the Ibeck children. And the woods were such lovely woods because they were pastures also. So the grass was all mowed down, chewed down, like mowed down. And they weren't brushy, but there were hazelnut trees to gather hazelnuts. And with the Sunday brothers, we made a kind of a fort in the woods. It was our special fort. There were 3 little kind of sapling fir trees. About like from here to there to there. And we got a 4th stick in the ground and made, that was the stability. We made kind of sideward and fir boughs for the roof. And that was our little clubhouse in the woods. And in the gathering hazelnuts was fun. Hazelnuts are like filberts, but filberts are the commercially grown nut. But the hazelnut is the wild filbert. And they're just wild in the woods, and the squirrels and the chipmunks get them. You try to get ahead of the squirrels before they get into them. And the nut is, it's kind of a green husk, and you take that off, and then the nut is smaller than a filbert and kind of whiter, but it's just a lovely, lovely taste. So that was another fun thing to do in the fall, is gather hazelnuts.
What were some new inventions when you were a child?
Well, let's see. In the 20s, I think, I wasn't, aware of it much at the time, but I think radio was just kind of coming on. Car had been invented only about 20 years before. I think the radio, television didn't come along until the 30s. And things, that's about as much as I can really remember as being a major invention, would be the radio. That's a big thing to have a little. They would start out with guys, kids would make a crystal set of some kind that they could tune in somehow with, and tune in stations here. But radio stations, like, there were three, KTW, KEX, and KOIN, that were connected to the national networks. That were the big thing.
What were some toys you played with as a child?
I had a doll, and she was a lovely doll named Suzanne, and she was the kind that, she was just a very pretty doll, and she, when you put her down, her eyes closed, but she had eyelashes. She wasn't like an infant baby. She was like a little, like a miniature Shirley Temple or something, and she had blonde hair that I liked to play with. And I would make I liked to sew, and I would make little clothes for her, little jackets and little skirts and things that I think I still have. That was fun to play with. And the toys, didn't have an awful lot of, didn't play marbles, things like that. I think that I had an old teddy bear too. And my dad made me a nice little doll bed too for Suzanne. And then I had a little table about half the size of this table, I guess, wooden table. I think my dad had made that too, and two little chairs. And I had a nice little tea set so I could have a friend over and we'd put water in the teapot, and I think we had like watermelon wedges or something. That was our tea party. Yeah.
What cars did your family own?
Good question. We had we were getting into the Depression, and I'm sure you know the Depression were hard times for everybody. So we had an old car. This I'm coming of age where I can remember back in about 1930 and on. And we had an old Edsel car. Not Edsel car, Essex, which they don't make anymore. It was just a black, very, very square, and it had the two front seats, just the two door, and then across the back seat. But we had that car until the late 30s, I think, when we got a Plymouth. Again, I think a two door with two seats in front, or they didn't have bucket seats. It was just across the seat, it was across the front and back seat across the back.
Did you ever go to the World Fair?
Yeah, I went to the one in 1962 in New York. I was living in New York at that time.
Yeah. What were some popular radio shows?
Well, the ones I remember were Fibber McGee, nice family shows that were Fibber McGee and Molly, and they were like an older couple, and they were... The running gag was when they were on weekly programs, I think they were for a half an hour. And the kind of running gag was he'd open the closet to get something and everything would fall out. So great sound effects of things falling out of the closet. Let's see what else. Didn't listen to the radio a lot. I got interested in classical music actually by listening to KOAC, which was broadcast from Oregon State College. They had half an hour or an hour maybe once a week, or maybe it was every night, that they played classical music. And that was, to my young ears, that was just, that sounded so nice. I got very interested in classical music. There were other popular radio shows that I can't remember. I didn't listen to them too much, I guess. Fibber McGee and Molly, I think, was a favorite.
What were some popular clothes or styles when you grew up?
Okay, that's a good question. Hairstyles for myself was what is just called a Dutch bob, and I think my mother probably cut my hair. I think I remember going to a local barber a few times, but just straight bangs and then down kind of straight across the back, so was just Soap Touch Bob. Then as I got older and in high school, it was hair was worn shoulder length and pin curls with bobby pins, if you're familiar with those little bobby pins. So you'd kept having it and twist it around and open the bobby pin and slide it in there that would hold it in this little curl. You do that when you went to bed at night, moisten it first, so, and then you take the pins out in the morning all around and comb it out, and it's all kind of fluffy.
Do you feel medical knowledge has improved a lot since you were growing up?
It surely has, yes. I've had several, I'm sure, things, well, let's see, happen to me, medical procedures that probably wouldn't have been, that were probably life-saving, that wouldn't have been available when I was a youngster, so in the course of my life. For example, I have a replaced knee, a knee replacement I had that done a couple of years ago. That certainly was something that came along not too many years ago, to be able to replace hips and knees and joints. And likewise, eyes. I had a cataract surgery, and that's a very simple procedure now. But many years ago, several decades ago, that was a very elaborate procedure, and you had to be your head perfectly still for like 2 weeks where everything healed. Well, that's a tremendous, tremendous change.
Do you feel technology has advanced much?
Oh, that's, yes, that's, not only is it just changing, has it changed so much, but it just changes so fast. It just keeps, it's like the magazine called Wired, I think, that it just changed. Is there, and it's just happening faster, that you just can't keep up. The minute you buy a product, it's already out of date, and another one is a better one or a newer one is now available. So you can't get the parts for your old machine.
How do you feel about the war?
The Iraq War?
Yeah.
Or about war, but the Iraq War. Yeah, I was opposed to that from the start. It just didn't seem like the right thing to do. There wasn't the right reasons for it, and it's not a good way to solve international problems.
Tell us about your father's Irish farm.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what we grew. We had this big 60-acre farm, and we grew a lot of wheat and other things for the cows. We had cows and horses. But my dad started growing Dutch iris bulbs, and they come in three colors, white and yellow and blue. And so there'd be these lovely ribbons of colors in the springtime. They bloom about May. All done by hand and a horse. My dad would, and I have an older brother, with a horse-drawn plow. I think they would plow out a furrow, soft earth, and then we would go with a bucket of bulbs and put them in the ground every 6 inches apart or so, row after these straight rows. And then either an implement by hand, the ground was then pushed back over the bulbs, so they're about 6 inches down. That was done in the spring, and then in the summer, in May, the flowers would bloom. And sometimes they cut the flowers and sold them to a florist in Portland, Tommy Luke. But then he decided that the bulb was really stronger and healthier if they didn't cut the flowers, so he let the flowers we'd cut some for ourselves and for friends, but not commercially. Then the hard part was digging the bulbs, and back with the horse-drawn plow again, and plowing out the fur where the bulb by now was dry. This would be in July. The bulb was now dry like an onion. It looked very much like an onion, a small onion. And he would, plow out the fur, and we'd go on our hands and knees with a bucket and getting the bulbs out of the soft earth. That wasn't hard to because the earth was soft, but it was hot. It was always hot. July was. And, row after row of those, that was really hard work. And we did most of it ourselves. I think later years, when the bulb field got larger, then they would hire local kids to help pick. And then my dad would sort the bulbs, keeping the colors separate and the varieties separate. And I think he had large screens that he got that he would shake them to shake all the loose dirt out, and then sack them up and sell them, the bulbs, to a bulb co-op in Portland. But one year, in amongst the blue wedgewoods, which were the early ones to bloom, row of them, there were a couple of white flowers, the perfectly white ones, not blue. So we thought, there's a market here, because they bloomed earlier than the others, and the other white ones and the yellow ones. So he's isolated these bulbs by themselves and planted them separately so that they came up next year nice and white, and a few of them had a little bit of blue. We, you know, put those aside and threw them away, and we planted the white ones, and so we got a nice strain of the white Wedgwood, which was normally blue. And he got quite a large stock of that and took it, so a patent office, and to patent it. I think you cannot patent vegetation now, but back then you could. This was about 1955. And he patented it, and the patent officer said, you need to give it a name, and name should be both, should indicate the locality. So my mother's name was Manette, so he named the bulb the Tualatin Manette. And we have those bulbs now, and I understand that maybe we'll plant some in the Heritage Garden when they plant a Heritage Garden here.
Did they have to irrigate those bulbs? Or the,
no, we never did that. No, just the normal rainfall was sufficient.
What pests bothered them?
I don't remember any pests. We did have one year a condition called mosaic, which discolored the bulbs, and I suppose discolored the flowers. And that was a bad scene. We nearly lost the farm when that happened, because it happened just, he would very carefully plant the next year's crop in a separate plot of ground, but apparently a little too close to where he had planted the previous years, so the disease then spread. So there for several years we were leasing land on apart from our own farm, another farm, you know, half a mile away or so, just to get the strain clear. But that was the only, with no bugs. It's that mosaic, which is a, I don't know what causes that, something weird.
How did the Historical Society start?
It started in 1986. I had grown up here in Tualatin and gone to Lewis and Clark College, and then this is 1948, I graduated, and then I worked in Portland for a couple of years, and then married and moved to New York City in Manhattan, and was there for 25 years as a magazine, worked on a magazine as an editor, the school magazine, and then came back in 1975, I think it was, and got acquainted with, among other people, or reacquainted with, Lois Martinazzi. I had been, I'd forgotten this sort of, but I had been her Sunday school teacher in that very building that's now the Heritage Center when it was a church. Her Sunday school teacher when she was little, and I was, I suppose, in high school. And then when I came back, began going to the church again, and there Lois was, now a grown-up woman, of course. And she and I were in the choir together. And we just realized that we both had a great interest in Tualatin history. She had grown up here, as had her father, as had her grandfather, so she knew from way back. But I was just interested in history generally, and local history. So I think it was a Boone's Ferry Days down in Wilsonville, about 1985 maybe, and I saw the Historical Society, or what meant for the Historical Society, there had a nice booth, and they had a big handmade quilt of various scenes of Wilsonville history. And I thought, gee, what a neat idea. Let's get together. So Lois was excited about it, too. So we thought, well, let's do something. Let's form the society. So the following year at the Crawfish Festival, I think we had a little booth and saying that we were going to do this and would you be interested, and got some interest going and some names and whatnot. Then we began, and got a number of people interested. And then we thought we need to put on some programs. And at that time, the only good facility for that was the senior center over there. It was fairly new then, too, with a large seating area. I mean, tables and chairs for eating, and then at a large seating area, so that would be a good place to meet. So we designed a program. I think our first one was on, I think it was the people, the Oregon, the settlers that came over the Oregon Trail. So we got, I think, a speaker to come out, and got some descendants of Oregon Trail pioneers, and there were quite a few of them living in the community, and some other artifacts and things, items that had come over on the trail with those early settlers that had been saved. And we advertised, got publicity out for the program, and I think that the admission, we charged admission, and we would serve refreshments that were appropriate for that program. So the kind of hardtack that the pioneers ate as they came over on the trail, they couldn't make breads, so hardtack. And I think berries, we got scattered blackberries, and I think jerky, they would have jerky. And then tea and coffee, of course, so it's foods appropriate to the program. And we advertised and publicized and got a good showing of people. I think we charged $5, I think, but the $5 would be give you membership in the community, in the Historical Society, brand new Historical Society. So we had a great turnout, I think, and we did I remember about 80 or 90 people came up. I remember lined up to get in the door to pay their $5 and join. And we did then that, so we got very enthusiastic about that, and we had programs not every month, but several times a year, I think, one on the early schools in Tualatin. We had a speaker there, and we had an old school desk and a lot of early school books and a lot of fun things. Those we had in the Braden, Van Raden, no, we had that in the senior center. And one on the Tualatin Indians, and we invited people for that program to bring any Indian artifacts they might have had. And since this area was all farmed way back, and the farmers were like my father and brother, were plowed with a horse, so you're very close to the soil, not like in a big tractor now and pulling the implements. So they would see little glittering pieces of things and then pick up an arrowhead, some long ones, 2 inches long, and some little tiny ones, and gathered them. So a lot of people have been doing that. So we had a nice display of people's arrowhead collections. And my brother had also found a really unusual and rather early, kind of predated the bow and arrow, called an atlatl, which was an oblong stone implement with little kind of grooves that were used to give heft to a spear, I guess, that the Indians would throw at a game. And my brother also found a bowl, a nicely carved out bowl, when he was fishing at the mouth of the Pano Creek over here. So we had artifacts listed out there. So that was a nice program. So that was that. Oh gosh! And then we had programs. Oh, and then for the Historical Society, for the Crawfish Festival, we had kind of a mini museum in the Van Raden Center, the large room at the Van Raden Center, and that was various like Christmas in July. So we had old-fashioned Christmas ornaments and early old-fashioned Christmas presents, and we had it. And another one, I think, on fashion, early fashion. So we just, every year, we had something at the Crawfish Festival in addition to our programs that we put on. Even had a program once on a harvest festival it was. So we had a milk cow. There used to be a dairy over here that had cows. We had them bring their cow over, and kids could milk the cow, see what that was like. And a woman still had her spinning wheel, so she brought that over and showed how they used to, a spinning wheel. And made some homemade apple cider from a person's apple orchard. So we just did a lot of interesting things like that to kind of show what Tualatin used to be like, what they used to do and how they used to dress and what they used to do. So that grew, and it a lot of people were interested enough, so it became a really large, thriving society that's still going.
So was that a big breakthrough for Tualatin to start a historical society?
Well, it seems so for us. I think there was just a lot of interest by this time, in maybe because so much of the history was being, old buildings were coming down and we're kind of losing our history, so people were kind of, gosh, remember how things used to be when there was this instead of this? So I think there was just kind of a general renewed interest in how things used to be that kind of getting up. But I think it was pretty successful.
How do you think Tualatin has changed over your lifetime?
Well, it has sure changed over my lifetime. It was when we moved here, which was 1928, I think it was, 27, when I was just a little baby. Tualatin was... It did have the two railroad systems. It had that corner brick store that they just moved. That was a store, the grocery store. There was another little grocery store. I think there was a service station. There was a meat market. And that was about it for Tualatin. And in that course of time, just look what has happened. Because I was gone in New York from 1950 to 1975, so I was away when much of the change was happening, but I would come back summers to visit my parents and my family, so I could see each time I came back, oh gosh, they tore that down, they built that up. So I could just see that. So the community just gradually changed from a farming community with farms, old farms all around the town, and so little traffic that roads, there was very little traffic on roads. One of the things my brother and I would do for amusement was sit on the front porch on the lawn swing and watch the cars go by and try to identify, oh, that's a Ford, yeah, that's a Ford, yeah. Watching, wait for a while, another one like, oh, that's a Plymouth. And, you know, it was about that slow that things, you know, were happening on the streets. And then some of that would come out, it would be, you know, more new things until now. We have so many such industry and so many, you know, schools and parks and everything. It's just boomed.
Well, that's it. So thank you for letting us interview.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I applaud your work in doing this. Interviewing people. Have you interviewed other people too?
Not yet. You're our first person.
Oh, I see. Well, yeah, I think Larry thought it would take half an hour. I think I speak fast.
Could you speak more about your books, the work you've
done? Okay, sure. Yeah, but I'm happy to do that. Again, Lois, as I said, had this vast amount of knowledge that her father was a great one to, you know, tell her stories about things that had happened when he was a kid and growing up in Tualatin, and the stories that his father, in turn, had told him about his earlier days in Tualatin. So she had this wealth of information in her. Plus, in 1970, it's the Oregon centennial year of 59. You kids should know that. Anyway, that was the centennial year. Oregon had been a state for 100 years. And Lois's mother, who was a journalist and wrote stories for the local paper, she did a series of interviews of the descendants of the original settlers who came out in 1850 in the Oregon Trail. She did a series of interviews with them, the descendants, the second generation, that were run in the local paper, a series of about, you know, what agriculture was like, what traffic, what water, just a whole series on that ran, I think, about 10 or so issues, so it was a good long series. That was later then compiled into a booklet by the Washington County Historical Society. So we had that as a resource, and we thought we should just write a book on the history of Tualatin. Let's do that. And this is about 1988, I think, or 89, that we started this. And oh boy, where to start? So we started gathering information going way back in physical time to the mastodon that was, bones were found right here in Tualatin and had been dug up and saved and assembled. And the history of the Indians, the Atfalati Indians that used to roam here. And then just the personal stories and getting from her. Well, but we just did a lot of research in the archives, just in finding microfiches of old newspaper copies in Oregon, the public library in Portland. So we started assembling information for just every step of the way of the development from the time that the Oregon Trail settlers came, and we were able to find from the Oregon Geological Society in Portland detailed information on all the families that settled in this area. That's now Tualatin. 15 families on their either 120 size acres, which is just enormous. It's like three times the size of the whole high school grounds, for example. It's about the size of an ordinary farm. And not only was it that size, but it was, most of them are covered with big trees, so they had to clear the land before they could even farm. So then, at the time that we were getting this together, both Lois and I moved away from Tualatin. I moved to California, and Lois moved to Lake Oswego. We both remarried, but we kept going long distance, and we just gathered the stories and gathered the pictures, and we knew there were a lot of pictures that people had that they came forward with, and also at the Oregon Historical Society in Portland, they have a very fine photographic collection there that we were able to tap into and get copies. And then the big problem was how to organize all this information. So we did it chronologically and not starting with what's the earliest was the mastodon, I guess, yeah, the discovery. No, before that was the the meteorite. I suppose you've heard about the story about that, but it's now in New York City in the National History Museum there, but it was found over outside of Tualatin city limits near Willamette. But that kind of started the story, and then put it together chronologically, gathered the pictures, and wrote the text, and got it to a printer, and it came out in 1994, I think it was. Yeah. This is now a second copy. The first copy was bound differently, just not the spiral, and that. So then we brought out a second edition that with the second edition. Bringing it up to date with the 10 years after from 1994 to 2004, and they brought this out in 2004 with this added chapter. And then we thought a series of articles or series of Fountain History, again, the written form, we happened to find there were four diaries. One was of the Oregon Trail pioneers. One was written by the fellow he came out here. Actually, he was not an Oregon Trail pioneer. He came up before there was even a trail. He came up by ship around the Horn from the East Coast, I guess, up the West Coast of North and South America and up the Columbia. He settled here, and he wrote a diary, kept an entry for every day of his several years that he was here. Somebody brought a copy of it to our attention. We thought, oh my gosh, what a treasure. So we laboriously transcribed it. It was pretty hard reading his handwriting, but it was preserved in pencil, I think. So that was one of four settlers. William Hayes, who was the one who wrote this one, and Maria Sweek of the Sweek House over here, she wrote a diary, or at least it was an interview done in the form of a diary. And then the Robbins family who had come out, a large family, and one of the fathers of that kept an entry of almost every day on the trail coming out, so just day by day. That's the third story in here. And the fourth diary is one of the Robbins daughters, who in hers was a terrifying account of coming down the Columbia River from, I guess, the Dalles down to Portland or Vancouver, whichever side they landed on. You think of the Columbia River being an easy river to sail down, but that's because there are dams, so it's just a series of kind of still pools until it gets down to the mouth. But back then, in 1850, it was just a torrential, raging river, and no banks to speak of, just the raw rock cliff sides. So it was just hideously dangerous. So this little 8 or 10-year-old girl wrote her diary of remembering what it was like to come down that raging river. So that was our life in the Life in a New Untamed Land, four diaries. And then, a couple of years later, we thought, we would reprint Lois's mother's articles that she wrote for the Centennial account with the second generation. So we reprinted that, and Tualatin's Past remembered the second generation tells its story, and again, finding pictures to illustrate that. Then a few years later, we thought, well, we'll bring it up to date. So from people who we could interview, like you're interviewing here, that we could interview who remembered what Tualatin was like in the 19-teens, 20s, and 30s. A lot of old-timers still around. So we interviewed a number of them, and the story of Tualatin when we were young. And lots of pictures again, and here are all these people told their story in this article, in this book. And now the one we're working on today is following that with memories of people from the 1940s, from the time World War II broke out, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, when it changed from this sleepy little Tualatin farming village to the big city it is that you know. Yeah. So that was the story there. And other things we've done, too, in using the photograph collection. We have making old note cards, and I think one year we did calendars, historic calendars with the covered bridges and the Tualatin River and early homes in Tualatin. But these books have been our main publications.
What's next?
Well, we're kind of running out. Well, another thing we did along the way, and this was kind of interesting, the Winona Cemetery over here, let's see my orientation over there, yeah. Many early Tualatin people. It was put in 1900, the cemetery. So we thought, let's do something that we called it a cemetery stroll at twilight, and we got, I think we strolled the cemetery, Lois and I did, excuse me, and got the names of those who were buried in Taunton, who the oldest ones, Nybergs and Byrams and Ladds and I guess Jurgens and all those families. And I wrote a kind of as if they told their life in each gravestone, as if that person told their life. So this took form in the form of an event. We called it a stroll. So people were coming at 4 o'clock. It was kind of October, I think. And so it was getting kind of dusky by 4 o'clock. So that's when we assembled, and we went from gravesite to gravesite, and this was all prearranged. A person, sort of in the costume of the person whose story was going to be told, came out from behind his gravestone and came forward. We were on the Cummins Trail that went kind of down the center of the cemetery, and that person either told, if they memorized it, or read their story. You know, came to Taunton as a little girl, and you know, in 1850, and then the end of her story. And then she went back and stood behind her graveyard gravestone, kind of out of sight. And then moved on to the next gravestone. And so I think there were 20 stories told in all, 20 grave sites we visited, and a costume person emerged from around the side and told his or her story. That was kind of fun. That's the kind of thing that would be kind of fun for you kids to do, to reenact something like that. You know, information is there and the stories are there.
Could you describe the mastodon?
Oh yeah, that was a weird thing. And just by happenstance, an old man named Charlie Roberts, he apparently in the swamp that's behind the other side of Fred Meyer, the kind of low spot there that's probably fills up with water in the wintertime maybe. But that used to be quite a full swamp, and it was quicksand, I'm sure, too, so that in the early, when the first settlers came here, their cows would sometimes get stuck in there, and then they had to drain it to drain the water out so that it would be just a good pasture area. And in digging, they found big bones here and there. And old Charlie Roberts was one who remembered there were the big bones, and he told young Bob George, I think is his name, who had become a neighbor, said that there's some big bones over there. And so this young kid was interested. So Charlie Roberts told him just where to dig, and he dug down. I think the old man thought they were elephant bones. But Bob said there couldn't be elephants, hadn't been elephants here. But he dug down about 6 feet, and by George, he found bones. But he knew just right where to dig, because old Charlie Roberts had remembered just where he had found some, you know, many, many years before when he was young. And they dug out all these big bones, rib bones, thigh bones, one long tusk. And it was, the kid took the bones in, he was a college student by this time, and he thought this could be his college thesis, I think. So he took the bones in, and they were determined to be mastodon bones, about 10,000, 15,000-year-old mastodon bones. But just half of the skeleton was found, and just one tusk. And so they figured that probably it had fallen into the quicksand, the alluvial swamp, and sunk in or some. And over the years, just the top half of the carcass was probably, you know, gnawed at by wolves or whatever, but the bottom half was sort of preserved as it sank further and further down. So here we have rescued, and they've been nicely reassembled with the missing half kind of in plaster or something, and it's over in the city hall now. But the Taunton is unique, certainly, to have its own mastodon skeleton. So.
Okay. Anything, Karen, you'd like to add to your story?
Well, let's see. I should have. Well, I think it's really heartwarming to see the interest in the history that went on, the kinds of lives that people used to live in the area where you live now. It's nice to know that. And it's nice to see people interested in saving what there is to save at that time, you know, its buildings or whatever. And as so often happens, you get interested in that just about the time that, you know, it's maybe been destroyed or burned or fallen into disrepair, and you can no longer save it. But we saved a number of things in Tualatin. The church over here to our Heritage Center is certainly one, and the brick store being saved. The old Sweek House, that was, so many of the things have been on the verge of being, you know, they're just not worth keeping. So, but if the right person comes along to buy it or to renovate it, whatever, that sees the virtue in saving the history.
Do you have some memories of some of those buildings? The old brick store?
The old brick store, yes, I can remember that. It was, didn't we, in those days when you went to a store, grocery store, you would just go to the counter and say, I want a can of string beans, and they would go up on the shelf and bring out the can of string beans. And I need a roll of string, a good roll of string. So they go over there and put out a roll of string and put it down. One by one, the things that you got, so that's all. So then they would take out a slip of paper and wet the blood vessel and write down that string, that's 5 cents. And the beans, that would be 15 cents. And total it up, you know. And you know, it's just all done by hand, and everybody trusted everybody. And this is an example of trust too. There was a meat market, and along in the 30s, when refrigeration, that by the way is another invention, was the refrigerator, I think, along in the 30s that became for people who could afford them. But the meat market had even a frozen compartment, I think it was, at least it was very cold, and local people would maybe butcher an animal, butcher a hog, or butcher a calf, or butcher a cow, and take it to the meat market man, and he would cut it up and wrap it up, and then put it with your name on it, and put it in the locker, in the freezer. You had your own little locker bin in there. And there was keys on the outside to get into the locked portion, but you just hung your key on the hook, so anybody could take anybody else's key, but you never did that. You used your own key to get in your own locker to get your own food. Yeah, just a lot of trust. And the other thing that is so different from now from then is, again, the safety. Back in the 30s, hard times, and it was very common men who just could not find work, as you may know or may not, that employment was just, you know, nobody could get a job. There just were not jobs. So some men would leave their wives and families, maybe with their parents, and just take to the road and see if we just managed to find something. And so hobos, they were called, that would just kind of wander from farm to farm in turn for some work. They could get a handout of food, and the housewife could fry up some potatoes and fry up some eggs and feed them. And now, what was my story going to be about? Well, that was just an example of the trust. Even with hobos, you know, kind of the neighborhood, that they were nothing dangerous or unsafe about them. They were just people in hard times. But you never locked your doors. I don't think we had a key to our farmhouse. And nobody did. Nobody was going to bother. Nobody was going to break in. Everybody trusted everybody. That was very different, I guess, from now.
So. Are there some other lessons we could learn from history today?
Well,
like that. Lost trust, but are there some?
Yeah, we have lost trust. Boy, that's a good one.
Or taking care of each other.
Taking care of each other, yeah. A sense of community, I think. That's a big one. There used to be such a sense of community. Things like barn raisings. Yes, a farmer needed a barn, so all the other people come around and help them raise the barn. And then a communal celebration, you know, supper or something following that. Just everything was very communal. So you knew everybody. People were, it's like it takes a village to raise a child. Everybody was kind of aware of other people. You could safely leave your child playing outside. That was a big difference. Kids were, and this is being shown in our book that we're working on now, Kids' Memories of the 40s, for example, and maybe even 50s. How safe it was to play long distance from home, you had to get back in time for dinner or something, but you could play safely. And people looked out for each other and did for each other as needed. I think now have become too concerned with material goods maybe to make that happen. We're kind of more keen on saving what we've got and ensuring it's protected and nobody's going to take it away, maybe. Yeah, there's a sense of community that I think has been lost. But be hard to...
Well, Ryan and Lauren, have you got any more questions you could think of?
No.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Well,
Karen.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to have the opportunity.
I'd like to have our interviewers stand behind you. With
okay, sure.
And get a picture of everybody together. on the video part. Mm-hmm. We're going to have still picture two, but...
You want me to stand up or...
Maybe sitting would be fine.
Okay, sure.
That's probably
sure.
One sitting.
Okay, okay.
And again, just for the record and the camera, let's make sure that they say their names and grade and end of the date.
Okay.
Can we leave that going?
Yep. Sorry, it was just going to be...
Yeah, we'll get that part for the video. We might want to. We're thinking we may make a movie someday or
no.
Video or something, you know, of some of this. But when they're 10 years from now, come back to Duval for a visit.
Right, you can print this video.
And they'll want to see this video they made or they were part of.
Right.
And laugh.
Right.
About that time. So if we're still able to get that right,
should we move a second?
And I'll get another still picture too.
I'm very impressed, Howdy. You're very, very professional there.
Didn't they ask some good questions?
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
They made those questions.
Yeah. Yeah, good questions.
And yeah, we'll use the tripod because I think the other focus is because it wasn't stable. Okay. I couldn't even get a signal myself.
So my name is Laura Holberg, and I'm going to be a ninth grader next year. And
I'm Ryan, and I'm going to be a sixth grader. So.
And I'm Karen Lafke-Nygaard, and I'm well out of school.
Okay, so we just want to make sure we got that on the video. Going to put this camera on the tripod to make sure we get a good still in this picture. And then, we're learning all this technology.
Sure,
we just bought it, so
we're trying
to figure out how it works.
This is what you got with the grant?
Right.
Yeah.
So you're kind of our guinea pig. Thanks for coming all the way to California.
Boy, yeah. That's
very interesting.
Does it work?
Well, it's not a standard tripod. Doesn't have the standard tripod.
Well, I think I got it okay here. I think so. I'm just trying to figure out why.
Yeah. Let's see if see what it's supposed to have is a standard tripod bottom. Where that goes. Oh, that's why. I'm tired. Hold on.
That has come on.
Yeah.
See, Ryan probably figured out. Yeah. Kids know this.
This isn't part of the camera. This is part of the tripod.
Yeah.
That's why it's confusing.
See, the older we get, the further, the harder for us to figure it out.
Right.
Ryan will always be better.
You kids are born knowing these things.
You won't drop your iPod part now.
I've dropped my Game Boy before.
Oh, yeah?
The front of it is all scratched up.
You dropped it, is it on the floor you mean, or dropped it into something?
I've dropped in the store, I've dropped it at home, I've dropped it like in the car, I've dropped it everywhere.
It still works?
Yeah. My friend, who's went through the wash.
So oh my goodness.
Like black line across the screen. And like it doesn't turn on very well.
They can still use it?
Yeah.
Can we see this? A little just snatch of it before we go.
Yeah.
Oh, I've never seen myself.
The video, we can show you.
That's what I meant. The video. Yeah.
Right. His brothers are going over to the next session, so he may have to run over there and make sure they got there.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Right.
But this little voice recorder right there is an amazing thing too.
That's right. I forgot to turn that off.
That's an amazing thing.
Good. It worked for the whole thing, I believe.